Welcome to Research at Texas A&M.
The following podcast, Frederick Douglass, Lincoln, and the Civil War, is from the Texas A&M Institute for Advanced Studies Eminent Scholar Lecture, presented by Dr. Robert S. Levine. Dr. Levine is a professor of English and a distinguished university professor, as well as the founding director of the Center for Literary and Comparative Studies at the University of Maryland. As a 2013-2014 TIAS faculty fellow, Dr. Levine is collaborating with Texas A&M's Department of English in the College of Liberal Arts.
I'm going to use a script, but I'm going to try to give an illusion that I'm talking as well, off the cuff. So it's a real honor to be speaking here today in the Eminent Scholar Lecture Series as a fellow in the Texas A&M Institute of Advanced Study. Four people made this happen, and I'd like to thank all of them. Thank you, Dr. John Jenkins, Director of the Institute. Thank you, Dr. Jose Barbudas, Dean of the College, who can't be here tonight. Thank you, Dr. Nancy Warren, Chair of the English Department. And thank you, Dr. Larry Reynolds, University Distinguished Professor of English and my faculty sponsor. And thank you, Nancy and John, for the kind introductions. And thank all of you for coming to hear what an English professor has to say about two great American leaders in the Civil War. And if you are like me and are from Boston, thank you for putting off watching the World Series for an hour to hear what I have to say about these two figures. And the talk is about 45 to 50 minutes, so thank you also for your patience. Frederick Douglass published three autobiographies. The 1845 narrative of Frederick Douglass, by far his most famous autobiography, but the one that brings him only up to the age of 27. The 1855, My Bondage and My Freedom, which some are now arguing is Douglass's best autobiography, and the 1881-1892, Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, which has been dismissed by many critics as self-indulgent and bloated. It's over 600 pages, but which I happen to love in part because Life and Times is the only of Douglass's book-length autobiographies that includes material on his interactions with Abraham Lincoln. And it has lots of other great things in it as well. But because of the Lincoln material, on that score alone, I find Douglass's final autobiography fascinating. But what's also fascinating is what happens when you read Douglass on Lincoln in Life and Times in relation to Douglass's other writings on Abraham Lincoln. In the 1881 Life and Times, Douglass mostly conveys his great admiration for Lincoln, and from beginning to end presents himself as an unwavering supporter, celebrating Lincoln as a leader who, from the moment he was elected, sought to bring about, and now I'm quoting, the ultimate extinction of slavery, end quote. And yet the fact of the matter is that from the time of Lincoln's inauguration in 1861 through most of 1864, Douglass was one of Lincoln's most vociferous critics, as is evident from even a cursory look at articles Douglass printed about Lincoln in his newspaper, which was called Douglass's Monthly. In 1861, Douglass writes that Lincoln's first inaugural address, quote, announced his complete loyalty to slavery in the slave states, prostrating himself before the foul and withering curse of slavery, end quote. Later that year, Douglass remarks that, quote, unless a new turn is given to the conflict, we might as well remove Mr. Lincoln out of the president's chair and respectfully invite Jefferson Davis or some other slaveholding rebel to take his place. Douglass declares in 1862 that, quote, the president of the United States seems to possess an ever-increasing passion for making himself appear silly and ridiculous, end quote, and that his politics have, quote, been calculated to shield and protect slavery from the very blows which its horrible crimes have loudly and persistently invited, end quote. As you will see or hear, Douglass would continue to speak critically of Lincoln in 1863 and 1864. Recent work by historians, mainly derived from Douglass's 1881 Life and Times, has told heartwarming stories about the Douglass-Lincoln relationship, emphasizing how these two great leaders, one black, one white, worked together to preserve the Union and bring about the end of slavery. While I think there's some truth to these accounts, I want to complicate matters this evening by doing what literary historians like to do, close reading and rhetorical contextualization. And I think literary critics like to do other things as well, but I won't mention those. The Douglas-Lincoln relationship during the Civil War is incredibly fascinating and inspiring too, but it's also more conflicted than the happy story we've been getting of an interracial collaboration, and for reasons I'll be elaborating, more mysterious too. Though I'll be raising questions about sentimentalized views of the Douglas-Lincoln relationship, I'm hoping that by the end of my talk, you'll find yourself admiring these two leaders even more. And in particular, we'll have a greater appreciation of Douglas as a strategic and performative autobiographer. So I'm not out to disillusion. There are three parts to my talk, and part one is titled The Facts, or What We Think We Know About Douglas and Lincoln. Douglas and Lincoln may have heard of one another before 1858, but 1858 is the year in which we know they were aware of each other. On June 16, 1858, Lincoln emerged from the Illinois Republican State Convention as the party's candidate for the U.S. Senate, and at the close of the convention, he gave his famous House Divided speech in which he declared, drawing from the Book of Mark, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently, half slave, half free." Douglas read a transcript of the speech, and in a lecture of August 2, 1858, he refers to what he calls, quote, "the great speech of Mr. Lincoln," end quote, and goes on to say that Lincoln's remarks were, quote, "well and wisely said. Liberty or slavery must become the law of the land." A few weeks after Douglas gave this lecture, the famous Lincoln-Stephen Douglas Senate debates got underway. They had six joint debates, and at five of them, Stephen Douglas played the race card by associating Lincoln with Frederick Douglass. So if Lincoln didn't know who Frederick Douglass was going into those debates, he would have quickly learned. At their first debate on August 21st, 1858, Stephen Douglas says that Lincoln, quote, "could receive baptism from Fred Douglass on abolitionism," end quote. At the second debate on August 27, 1858, Stephen Douglas claims that he saw Frederick Douglass accompanied by white women in a carriage driven by a white man. You know, horrors. And Stephen Douglas remarks, quote, "I am told also that one of Fred Douglass's kinsmen, another rich black Negro, is now traveling this part of the state making speeches for his friend Mr. Lincoln, who is the champion of the black man's party," end quote. Lincoln, of course, lost the Senate election, but the debates positioned him for the presidential election of 1860. Douglas initially supported the radical abolitionist party candidate for president, Gerrit Smith, but eventually threw his support to the victorious Lincoln. Then came Douglas's disillusionment, which, as I've just noted, he expressed in his lectures and the essays printed in his newspaper. This background sets the scene for their three meetings at the White House between 1863 and 1865. Again, this is what we know. During 1862, Lincoln, who hated slavery but also seemed not to care very much about blacks, worked on impractical schemes to colonize African Americans to Central or South America, convinced that the United States would work best as a nation without slavery and without blacks. On August 14, 1862, Lincoln met with a delegation of African Americans, not including Douglas, and he lectured the black leaders about the advantages of black colonization to the Southern Americas. The meeting was widely reported, and Douglas was furious at Lincoln, attacking him in several lectures. Some historians think this meeting was staged, Lincoln meeting with the delegation of kind of not terribly distinguished African Americans, an effort on Lincoln's part to keep the border states in the Union fold by appearing to be unsympathetic to blacks, even as he was moving toward the Emancipation Proclamation, which was formally announced on January 1st, 1863. The proclamation, it's worth underscoring, freed only the slaves in the Confederate states, if they could be freed, not in the Union border states like Douglas's home state of Maryland, where slavery remained legal for nearly two more years. The proclamation had a provision for recruiting black troops into the Union Army, which Douglas had been urging for some time, and by spring 1863, Douglas was actively recruiting black troops, and two of his own sons served in the Union Army. Blacks quickly distinguished themselves in major battles, but Douglas remained concerned about two matters: unequal pay for black soldiers, and the Confederates' practice of treating black soldiers as insurrectionists who could be killed upon capture. Douglas therefore decided that he needed to talk directly to President Lincoln. So it was a very different world back then. Presidents actually spent much of their day, kind of like department chairs today, meeting with a range of people who came to the White House. On August 10, 1863, Douglas managed to meet with Edwin M. Stanton, Lincoln's Secretary of War, and with Lincoln himself. In what was probably a short but gracious meeting, Lincoln explained to Douglas why he had to move slowly on issues like equal pay for blacks. He may have also given his thoughts on policies of retaliation, and Stanton and Lincoln talked about making Douglas an officer in the Union Army. I'll have more to say about this first meeting in a few minutes, but let me turn to what we know about the second meeting. And for those of you who have a handout, there's a one-sentence summary of each meeting, so you can remember all this later. If you don't have a handout, get one when you leave, if you like one. However gracious Lincoln may have been to Douglas in August 1863, Douglas turned on Lincoln by 1864. He believed that Lincoln was still looking to make a deal with Southern enslavers, and he initially chose not to support Lincoln for re-election. Perhaps aware of Douglas's criticisms, Lincoln requested a meeting with Douglas, which is interesting. And on August 25th, 1864, a little more than a year after their first meeting, they met to discuss a question on Lincoln's mind: how the Southern slaves in the Confederate states could contribute to the war effort. Douglas set forth a plan to organize groups of Northern blacks to infiltrate Southern lines and spread the news of the slaves' emancipation. Though Lincoln never adopted this plan, the upshot of the meeting was that Douglas came to feel more warmly toward Lincoln, convinced that Lincoln was no longer a colonizationist, someone who wanted to ship blacks out of the country, and was no longer looking for a negotiated settlement with Southerners that would perpetuate slavery. He decided to support Lincoln for the presidency, attended the second inauguration on March 4th, 1865, and then, and this constitutes their third meeting, attempted to enter the inaugural reception in the White House. Douglas was initially barred by White House security, but Lincoln or someone on his staff insisted that he be let in, and Douglas was able to compliment Lincoln on his great inaugural speech. 1 month later, Lincoln was struck down by John Wilkes Booth. Douglas, who was in Rochester, New York at the time, gave an off-the-cuff improvised eulogy. And several months later, Douglas received a gift from Mary Todd Lincoln, Lincoln's favorite walking stick. So that is what we know. We think we know more, that they were friends, that they were collaborators. But my questions are many. Based on these facts, can we refer to Douglas and Lincoln as friends and collaborators, which is how they are described by the historians you'll find in the bibliography on the handout? I'm willing to concede that they may have come to regard each other as friends in the way that politicians and leaders can refer to friendship. And I'm also willing to concede that there may have been some collaboration or influence influence or even cross influence between the two men that goes beyond their scant three meetings over 3 years. After all, they were aware of each other's views during most of the Civil War. But what interests me as a literary scholar and cultural historian is that virtually everything we know about the relationship between the two men, and especially their three meetings, comes from the writings of Frederick Douglass. Lincoln has nothing to say about Douglass that we can read in print, no testimonials, no discussion of their meetings. It's also worth noting that Douglass's accounts of his meetings with Lincoln vary widely and are often based on memories that are written up years later and at moments when it served Douglass's interest to link himself with the revered Abraham Lincoln. I don't have time to review Douglass's various representations between 1863 and 1893, except to say if you're interested, get out the multi-volume Frederick Douglass papers published by Yale University Press and look at the index. There's a lot of stuff, a lot of lectures and essays that Douglass has about Lincoln. But it's certainly worth emphasizing again that the main source for recent accounts of these meetings is Douglass's 1881 Life and Times, which Douglass wrote at a time when he was under attack for supposedly mismanaging the Freedmen's Bank and for contesting the black exodusters. And these were blacks who decided that racism was so severe in the South that they had to move north. Douglass told Southern blacks to stay put and was roundly criticized, and thus, arguably, found it useful to show how tight he was with Lincoln, who was revered by that time. So my thesis is that Douglass is a fascinating rhetorical and performative writer of autobiography who, like any great autobiographer, is not entirely to be trusted on the facts. Coming to the Douglass-Lincoln relationship as a literary scholar, I say this actually with great admiration for Douglass, who knew that autobiography is always rhetorical and strategic. Coming at the Douglass-Lincoln relationship as a literary historian who is a historian wannabe, I'd be wary of sentimentalizing the relationship between Douglass and Lincoln based simply on Douglass's autobiographical accounts. Their relationship, as good as Douglass later presented it, is more conflicted than Douglass lets on, which is immediately clear, as I say, by comparing Douglass's essays and lectures of the 1860s to his accounts of his three meetings with Lincoln in the 1881 Life and Times. So what I want to do now, relatively quickly, is to look again at one of those three meetings from the perspective of a literary critic or close reader, and then address a nagging question about the Douglass-Lincoln relationship. If they were so tight, and if Lincoln so admired Douglass, why didn't he carry through on what Douglass said was the promise made during the August 1863 meeting to give Douglass an officer's position in the Union Army? So, to return to August 1863. In the 1881 Life and Times, Douglass offers a wonderfully dramatic account of his first meeting with Lincoln. "I shall never forget my first interview with this great man," he says. "There was no vain pomp and ceremony about him. I was never more quickly or more completely put at ease in the presence of a great man than in that of Abraham Lincoln." He recalls that, quote, "long lines of care were already deeply written on Mr. Lincoln's brow and his strong face full of earnestness. I at once felt myself in the presence of an honest man, one whom I could love, honor, and trust without reserve or doubt." And you no doubt get the idea. Douglass is reverential. He is looking up to the careworn president. But as the scene develops, something important happens. The great Lincoln takes on the role in Douglass's final autobiography of making clear that Douglass is the great representative African American leader of his time. For as Douglass begins to identify himself, Lincoln interrupts him to say, "I know who you are, Mr. Douglass. Sit down. I am glad to see you." You'll recall that Douglas's main purpose in wanting this meeting with Lincoln was to argue for equal pay for the black troops and to ask Lincoln to consider retaliating when black prisoners were summarily executed by the Confederate Army. When Douglas makes these requests, he says that, quote, "Mr. Lincoln listened with patience and silence to all I had to say," end quote. After mulling over Douglas's arguments, Lincoln states that he has to move slowly because there are popular prejudices against blacks, but that the pay for black and white soldiers will one day be equal. As for retaliation, in the 1881 account, Lincoln says that killing Southern soldiers in an eye-for-eye way would be, quote, "a terrible remedy," end quote, that could get out of hand and would lead to the death of innocent people. Douglas's response in the 1881 account is to display a surprising sympathy for Lincoln's position. Quote, "In all this, I saw the tender heart of the man rather than the stern warrior, and while I could not agree with him, I could but respect his humane spirit," end quote. The meeting ends with Lincoln promising that, quote, he would sign any commission to colored soldiers whom his Secretary of War, Edward Stanton, should commend to him, end quote, and with Stanton himself saying that a commission for Douglas is in the works. Though Douglas never gets the commission, in this 1881 account, Lincoln comes off as a great man, as no racist, and as befitting the 1881 context of reunion and reconciliation, deeply concerned about North and South alike and not wanting to use killing retaliation against white Southerners. Douglas told numerous stories about this August 1863 meeting. I will share one from late 1863, but I should first note that in the same month that Douglas met with Lincoln, the Lincoln he presents so reverentially in 1881, he had some unsparing words for the president in his newspaper that do not make their way into the 1881 Life and Times. Responding to the murder of scores of blacks during the July 1863 New York City draft riots and to the unequal treatment of black soldiers, Douglas accused Lincoln in his newspaper of, quote, "indifference and contempt for the lives of colored men," end quote. And he insisted that Lincoln adopt a policy of retaliation for any black soldier killed in cold blood by Confederate troops. This critique was published the same week Douglas met with Lincoln. Interestingly, by the time of the meeting, Lincoln actually had issued an order of retaliation. And according to a letter that Douglas wrote privately to his friend George L. Stearns 2 days after he met with Lincoln, he thanked Lincoln in person for issuing that order. But in his public writings, he presented Lincoln as reluctant to sign a retaliation order into law. In 1881, I posit, because in the post-Reconstruction moment, he wants to present Lincoln as a national leader who refused to be vindictive toward the South. And in 1863, I again posit, because he remained convinced that Lincoln didn't care about blacks in light of his failure to comment on the mass killings of African Americans during the New York City draft riots. As a critic of Lincoln, Douglas, in his 1863 accounts of the August meeting, as opposed to the 1881 account, presents himself as much less deferential to Lincoln, putting himself on a level and arguably even superior plane when, for example, describing the meeting in a December 4, 1863 lecture to the American Anti-Slavery Society. To give you a sense of Douglas's tone in this contemporary account of his first meeting with Lincoln, here are a few snippets from the lecture as captured by a reporter on the scene who also, as you'll hear, reports on the crowd's response. "Let me tell you how I got to him," Douglas says, "because everybody can't get to Lincoln. The stairway was crowded with applicants. They were white, and as I was the only dark spot among them, I expected to have to wait half a day. But in 2 minutes after I sent in my card, the messenger came out and respectfully invited Mr. Douglas in. I could hear in the eager multitude outside as they saw me pressing and elbowing my way through, pressing and elbowing my way through the remark, "Yes, damn it, I knew they would let the nigger through," in a kind of despairing voice. A peace Democrat, I suppose. Laughter. When I went in, the president was sitting in his usual position, I was told, with his feet in different parts of the room, taking it easy. Laughter. And again, this is Douglas talking to the crowd and then the reporter reporting on the crowd response. As I came in and approached him, the president began to rise, and he continued to rise until he stood over me. Laughter. And he reached out his hand and said, "Mr. Douglas, I know you. I have read about you, and Mr. Seward has told me about you," putting me quite at ease at once. End quote. Douglas then does most of the talking and overall has good things to say about what he terms Honest Abraham. But he concludes by saying that forces larger than Lincoln are going to get the job done, by which he means God in tandem with white and black abolitionists. One thing that he doesn't mention in this account is the promise of a military commission, which by this time Douglas knew had fallen through. Perhaps he wanted to save himself from embarrassment. Just a few words on the other two meetings. In the 1881 Life and Times account of the second meeting in August 1864, Douglas says nothing about the fact that he had initially decided not to campaign for Lincoln's reelection and instead uses both the August 1864 meeting at the White House and the March 1865 meeting at the inauguration to reinforce the idea that Douglas was the black man Lincoln most admired. Douglas describes the plan that he presented to Lincoln in 1864 about involving Southern black slaves in the Union effort, saying that Lincoln agreed, and there's no support for this, quote, "to undertake the organizing of a band of scouts composed of colored men to go into the rebel states beyond the lines of our armies and carry news of emancipation and urge the slaves to come within our boundaries," end quote. But equally important to this 1881 account is the display of Lincoln's admiration for Douglas. When Governor William Buckingham of Connecticut is announced as waiting to speak to Lincoln, Lincoln, according to Douglas, says to his personal secretary, "I want to have a long talk with my friend Frederick Douglass." And Douglas says that, quote, "this was probably the first time in the history of this republic when its chief magistrate had found an occasion to exercise such an act of impartiality between persons so widely different in their position." Lincoln's, or Douglas's, high opinion of Douglas is also reinforced in Douglas's story of his attendance at the inauguration. Barred from the reception, Douglas challenges the White House security officers, and someone, probably not Lincoln, gave him clearance. Here's the scene at the inaugural reception as Douglas describes it. And just so you won't think I'm too cynical, I'm going to assume this is mostly true while making the obvious point that telling the story in 1881 had dividends for Douglas. So here's what Douglas writes. "Mr. Lincoln stood in his grand simplicity and homely beauty. Recognizing me, even before I reached him, he exclaimed so that all around could hear him, 'Here comes my friend Douglas.' Taking me by the hand, he said, 'I am glad to see you. I saw you in the crowd today, listening to my inaugural address. How did you like it?' I said, 'Mr. Lincoln, I must not detain you with my poor opinion when there are thousands waiting to shake hands with you.' 'No, no,' Lincoln said. 'You must stop a little, Douglas. There is no man in the country whose opinion I value more than yours. I want to know what you think of it.' And I think this is all true, of course. I replied, 'Mr. Lincoln, that was a sacred effort. I am glad you liked it,' he said, 'and I passed on feeling that any man, however distinguished, might well regard himself honored by such expressions from such a man.'" And that's the end of the wonderful passage. Following the assassination, Douglas would tell his tales about Lincoln in numerous Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction lectures and essays. As a literary historian, I think that Douglas does skillful rhetorical work in these stories, making it seem as if Lincoln basically interacted with just one African American, the representative leader, Frederick Douglass, when in fact he had numerous interactions with other African Americans. I will discuss one such interaction in a moment. But a question remains. If Lincoln admired Douglas in the way that Douglas suggests, why didn't he name Douglas one of the first black officers in the Union Army? That's one of the many mysterious and probably unanswerable questions about their relationship, but I'm going to attempt to answer it. And then I get a strategic sip of water as you're waiting for the answer. People lean forward. So I've given part two a very poetic title. Why didn't Lincoln give Douglas a military commission? In his account in the 1881 Life and Times of his first meeting with Lincoln in August 1863, Douglas concludes by saying that Stanton and Lincoln promised to name him, quote, assistant adjutant to General Thompson, who was then recruiting and organizing troops in the Mississippi Valley, end quote. Douglas assumes he'll get this or some other military commission in 2 weeks' time, but he never hears back from Stanton. Douglas offers a terse report on his disappointment in his 1881 autobiography. Quote, for some reason, however, my commission never came through. The government, I fear, was still clinging to the idea that positions of honor in the service should be occupied by white men, end quote. And yet, as Benjamin Quarles points out in his classic 1953, The Negro in the Civil War, a book that's on the bibliography in the handout, by the end of the Civil War, there were over 100 commissioned African-American officers. So Douglas simply is wrong about what he says about positions of honor going only to white men. Given that Douglas failed to get a commission, we could ask about the reliability of his account of his August 1863 meeting with Lincoln and Stanton. Was it quite the love fest he suggests? We'll never know because we only have Douglas's evolving accounts of the meeting. But let us assume for the moment that Douglas's retrospective account of his meeting with Lincoln is reasonably accurate. Then his disappointment is real to the point that, as he does not mention in his 1881 autobiography, he initially supported John C. Fremont for the presidency in 1864. In the 1881 autobiography, there is only one other moment in which Douglas records the sort of disappointment that he expresses when he fails to get the military commission, and that is when Harriet Beecher Stowe, and someone before this talk told me that she had just read Uncle Tom's Cabin, so this I dedicate to you. The other disappointment is when Harriet Beecher Stowe fails to come through on what he took as her promise to help him fund a Black Mechanics Institute during the 1850s. That first disappointment with Stowe may help to cast light on his second disappointment with Lincoln. So let me digress for a few minutes with a story about Frederick Douglass and Uncle Tom's Cabin that pivots around the figure of the Black nationalist Martin Delaney. Martin Delaney was a well-known Black leader in the 19th century, but if you want to know more about him, do not read Douglass's 1881 Life and Times, because you won't find his name mentioned even once. This is surprising, because Delaney was the co-editor of Douglass's first newspaper, The North Star, and the person Douglass regularly debated about critical issues in the culture, including their responses to the 1852 Uncle Tom's Cabin. From Delaney's point of view, as he argued in three public letters to Douglass, Stowe was a racist and colonizationist, and Douglass was a fool not to see that. But even as Delaney was attacking Stowe for being a colonizationist, someone who wanted, as I say, to ship U.S. blacks to Africa or just out of the country, Delaney was arguing for the merits of black immigration, blacks on their own deciding to relocate to Central America or Africa. Responding to Delaney's critiques of Stowe, Douglass argued that Delaney's black immigrationism worked against African Americans' efforts to gain their rights of citizenship in the United States and wasn't all that different from Stowe's alleged colonizationism. In response to Douglass, Delaney in 1854 published his most powerful defense of black immigrationism, a tract called Political Destiny of the Colored Race on the American Continent, in which he argued that blacks could gain the rights of citizenship and become part of the ruling classes by immigrating to Central or South America. as Douglass absolutely does not mention in his 1881 Life and Times when he laments Lincoln's unwillingness to appoint a black Union officer. 10 years and a few months after Delaney published his Black Immigrationist tract, Abraham Lincoln named Delaney the first black major in the Union Army. So why should this have been so? So here's one possible answer. Lincoln found Delaney to be more impressive than Douglass. That's one possible answer. Though Douglass presents himself as the only African-American meeting with Lincoln during the Civil War, shortly after Lincoln had his second meeting with Douglass in August 1864 to ask him how the Southern black slaves could be deployed to bring about the end of the war, Lincoln met with Martin Delaney to ask him the same question. Delaney describes that meeting in an as-told-to biography published in 1868, and in that biography, we get Delaney's account of his meeting with Lincoln. In interesting ways, the account parallels the account that Douglass would give years later in Life and Times. In the 1868 Life and Public Services of Martin R. Delaney, Delaney says that the main reason he got the commission as major is because it was he, Delaney, who proposed the most compelling plan to Lincoln for encouraging black insurrection among the Southern slaves. Here's what Delaney claims he said to Lincoln. And who knows what he said? We don't have Lincoln's account. There's no corroboration. Though Delaney does become the first black major. So here's what he says, quote, "I propose, sir, an army of blacks commanded entirely by black officers. This army to penetrate through the heart of the South and make conquests with the banner of emancipation unfurled, proclaiming freedom as they go, keeping this banner unfurled until every slave in the South is free according to your proclamation," end quote. According to the biography, as told to biography, Lincoln exultantly proclaimed in response, quote, "This is the very thing I have been looking for and hoping for, but nobody offered it. I have thought it over and over again. I hoped and prayed for it. Will you take command?" End quote. In a letter to Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton, included in the 1868 biography of Douglass, Lincoln refers to Delaney, the 1868 biography of Delaney. Lincoln refers to Delaney as, quote, "this most extraordinary and intelligent black man," end quote. And it is Delaney and not Douglass who gets the commission as major. So perhaps Delaney got the commission because Lincoln saw him as intelligent and extraordinary and liked his plan about having an invasion force go into the South and recruit the black slaves. But here's another possible answer to the question of why Delaney over Douglass. When Lincoln in 1862 was most intent on pushing his plan of black colonization to Central and South America, he or one of his advisors read Martin Delaney's 1854 Political Destiny of the Colored Race on the American Continent, which, as I've noted, argued for black immigration to Central and South America. And he or someone on his staff was so impressed by the arguments that the text was reprinted in the 1862 Congressional Record. Ironically, then, Lincoln may have chosen Delaney over Douglass because he saw him as something of a fellow traveler in his own belief about the value of colonizing blacks to Central America, even though Delaney supported selective black immigration and not forced colonization. That said, neither Lincoln nor Delaney were static in their beliefs about colonization or immigration. Both went back and forth on the issue during the final years of the Civil War, with Lincoln seeming to have abandoned his plan, and Delaney himself, after the Civil War, choosing to work as an officer in the Freedmen's Bureau in South Carolina. For a while, Delaney sustained his belief in U.S. nationalism before taking up immigrationism again in the late 1870s. So all this brings me back to Frederick Douglass. Douglass's failure to get any sort of military commission, which I think still remains a mystery, given that Lincoln appointed many other blacks to such commissions, may possibly speak to Lincoln's sense that Douglass was too independent or too radical, or just someone whom he would never be able to control. Or the failure of Douglas to get the commission could be taken as a metaphor. So now I'll wear my literary hat. It could be taken as a metaphor for the missing side of the Douglas-Lincoln relationship, which is to say that Lincoln's decision not to appoint Douglas could be viewed, in effect, as one of Lincoln's tales of Douglas. Maybe Lincoln hadn't quite taken to Douglas as much as Douglas thought, and maybe Lincoln was simply being strategic in meeting with Douglas during the time of his second campaign for the presidency and flattering him in the ways Douglas describes. We'll never know. What we do know is that the Douglas-Lincoln relationship was a bit more troubled and much less of a hermetic binary than Douglas lets on, and at least one important facet of the relationship would appear to be that each person knew how to make use of the other, which does not mean that these figures didn't respect or even come to love each other in the way that political leaders can love each other. And I think political leaders love each other in ways different from most human beings, actually. I want to conclude with Douglas's most famous speech about Lincoln, where we can see pragmatism and admiration going hand in hand, along with a very powerful historicism, and perhaps even a touch of love. So part three, the concluding section, is titled Douglas on Lincoln in 1876. I've been suggesting that Douglas made pragmatic use of his interactions with Lincoln, particularly in the 1881 Life and Times, where he found it advantageous to link his star to Lincoln's. Douglas was hardly alone in adopting such a strategy, and to help illuminate what Douglas was up to post-Civil War, I want to quickly consider Walt Whitman on Lincoln, if that's okay with you. During the Civil War, Whitman lived in Washington, D.C., working as a volunteer at the open-air hospitals housing thousands of wounded and dying Union soldiers. At the time, he was a little-known poet whose first edition of Leaves of Grass, published in 1855, sold in the mere hundreds of copies. He remained relatively unknown as a poet until later in the century, which is not to say that he remained unknown, for he had begun to emerge in the public eye in the post-Civil War years by laying claim to Lincoln. In his 1876 memoranda during the war, Whitman described how during the Civil War he saw Lincoln on a daily basis. They never actually spoke to one another, but Whitman regularly observed him, and he reports in this autobiographical text on their eye contact, which he says signified their brotherhood. Was Whitman delusionary or shrewd? Perhaps a combination, though shrewd may be the best answer, which is not to say that he didn't love and admire Lincoln as a great leader. He wrote one of his greatest poems, the 1865 When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed, about the assassination, presenting Lincoln as a Christ figure, and in his 1879 lecture, The Death of Abraham Lincoln, he celebrates the assassinated president as, quote, the first great martyr chief, end quote, praising him as Douglas would praise him for helping to, quote, lastingly condense a nationality by the absolute extirpation and erasure of slavery from the United States, end quote. But there's also something odd and even opportunistic about the 1879 speech on the death of Abraham Lincoln. In the speech, Whitman assumes an intimacy with Lincoln based on those silent looks he claimed they gave one another during Whitman's Civil War years in Washington. He also gives a blow-by-blow account of the assassination from the point of view of someone who seems to have been at Ford's Theater, when the truth of the matter is that Whitman heard about the assassination while visiting his mother in Brooklyn. Nevertheless, what Whitman quickly saw is that the speech made him increasingly famous, and so he continued to give the Death of Abraham Lincoln speech in his remaining years. His most famous performance of the lecture was in 1887 at Madison Square Garden Theater. Among the 500 people in the sold-out packed theater were Mark Twain, James Russell Lowell, John Hay, and Jose Marti. Whitman followed the lecture as an aside, there was a banner advertising this lecture that said that Whitman was at Ford's Theater when Lincoln was assassinated. Whitman followed the lecture, as he regularly did, with a recitation of his most popular Lincoln poem, O Captain, My Captain, a poem he didn't hold in high regard, but knew that his audiences loved. The critic David Haven Blake has argued that Whitman used Lincoln, at least in part, to sanctify and promote himself. I think that something similar could be argued about Douglass's post-Civil War speeches and writings about Lincoln, and I say this, again, with no trace of disrespect, which is to say that I admire both Douglass and Whitman for their ongoing meditations on Lincoln and for their skillful rhetorical and performative work in linking themselves so powerfully to the first great martyr chief. I do think that Douglass had a lot more to say about Lincoln than Whitman because he actually conversed with him and because he was more passionately committed to racial democracy. I'd like to conclude with a look at what I regard as Douglass's greatest speech about Lincoln, his April 14, 1876 oration on the occasion of the Freedmen's Monument in memory of Abraham Lincoln, which, like Whitman's The Death of Abraham Lincoln, helped to consolidate his celebrity status. Douglass used the occasion of the speech to think historically and complexly about Lincoln, offering insights into Lincoln and slavery and Lincoln and race that simply haven't been matched until the recent work of Eric Foner, whose Pulitzer Prize-winning book explores interconnections between Lincoln's racism and anti-slavery. Douglass was able to address these topics around 140 years before Foner, in part through prescient political analysis and in part by making use of his autobiographical insights. So let me set the scene of the speech. In 1876, the year of the nation's centennial, Douglass was invited to be the main speaker honoring the unveiling of the sculptor Thomas Ball's The Freedman's Monument, a sculpture paid for by donations from the freed blacks. As you can see in the handout, so if you don't have the handout, you can get it later. But I have an image here, and I don't do PowerPoint. And for me, this is the first time I've ever included an image on a piece of paper. So I really feel I've made progress. So as you can see in the handout, the sculpture depicted Lincoln as a benevolent Christ or Moses or God figure offering his blessings over the body of a manacled black male slave based on an actual fugitive slave from Missouri. So it's worth emphasizing that this hierarchical image of the lordly Lincoln freeing the objectified passive slave spoke to general cultural understandings of blacks' indebtedness to the great emancipator. Douglass hated the image of the manacled kneeling slave, so he came to the lecture with some real animus against Ball's sculpture, along with a desire to tell the truth about Lincoln, race, and slavery to the audience assembled in Washington, D.C.'s Lincoln Park. And what an audience it was. In attendance that day, on April 14, 1876, was President Ulysses S. Grant, whom Douglass very much admired, members of the cabinet, Supreme Court justices, numerous senators and congressmen, and hundreds of ordinary citizens. In his 1881 Life and Times, Douglass says, that, quote, "The part taken by me in the ceremonies of that grand occasion rank among the most interesting incidents of my life," end quote. And though he doesn't actually comment on what he said in his speech, he writes that, quote, "Occasions like this have done wonders in the removal of popular prejudice in lifting into consideration the colored race," end quote. Speaking in 1876, Douglass felt a special urgency about lifting into consideration the colored race, for Reconstruction was failing, and it would formally end just 1 year later with the Compromise of 1877, which brought about the removal of federal troops protecting blacks in the South. Douglass's approach to removing popular prejudice rested in part on not genuflecting before Lincoln, not becoming the oratorical analog to the image of the kneeling, shackled slave. So Douglass unshackled himself and spoke bravely and honestly, presenting a boldly historicist picture of Lincoln as indifferent to the plight of the black slaves and a bit too intent on trying to appease border state racists. This is the Lincoln that Douglass criticizes in his 1860s newspaper writings and not the Lincoln he sanitizes in the 1881 Life and Times. Douglass states at the beginning of the speech, Quote, truth compels me to admit even here, in the presence of the monument we have erected in his memory, Abraham Lincoln was not, in the fullest sense of the word, either our man or our model. He was preeminently the white man's president, entirely devoted to the welfare of white men. He was ready and willing at any time during the last years of his administration to deny, postpone, and sacrifice the rights of humanity in the colored people to promote the welfare of the white people of his country, end quote. And Douglas doesn't stop there. Lincoln, Douglas says to his distinguished audience of 1876, was willing to pursue recapture and send back the fugitive slave to his master and to suppress a slave rising for liberty, though his guilty masters were already in arms against the government. This critique of Lincoln as willing to appease the slave states by returning fugitive slaves was especially cutting, given that the black man in the Freeman's statue was a fugitive slave, and not only that, was from the border state of Missouri, and thus was not freed by the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, but by state legislation in 1865. And people have done research on the statue, have actually identified the particular fugitive slave that Ball had modeled the statue on. In effect, Douglas is saying that Thomas Ball got things all wrong. I'm just touching on Douglas's charges against Lincoln. There are more. So why is it that I find the speech one of the most profound and moving meditations that we have on Lincoln? In large part because Douglas's rhetorical tactics are so historicist. For the thrust of the first half of the lecture is to situate Lincoln in his mid-19th century culture, in which most whites regarded blacks as not quite human and hardly their equals. Douglas presents these views as a cultural given and then makes a remarkable turn in the second half of the lecture to underscore that Lincoln's greatness was about being able to make bold and humane decisions about the multiracial future of American democracy from within a mindset that had kept most white American political leaders from imagining such a thing. Though Douglas plays down his own influence on Lincoln in this particular speech, withholding his personal remarks until the very end, he presents himself somewhat in the way Whitman imagined himself to have been in Ford's Theater, as there in Lincoln's head as he, quote, saved his country from dismemberment and ruin and freed his country from the great crime of slavery. And I'd recommend that you take a look at the speech, because it's kind of amazing how he enters into Lincoln's head and kind of presents himself as understanding the various things that he is considering. Douglas is at his historicist best when he goes on to tell his auditors not to consider stray facts in isolation, which can be a problem in so-called politically correct criticism, but to look at the big picture. We saw him, measured him, estimated him, Douglas remarks, not by stray utterances to injudicious and tedious delegations who often tried his patience, not by isolated facts torn from their connection, not by any partial and imperfect glimpses caught at inopportune moments, but by a broad survey in the light of the stern logic of great events, end quote. From that perspective, Douglas insists, it was enough for us that Abraham Lincoln was at the head of a great movement and was in living and earnest sympathy with the movement, which in the nature of things must go on till slavery should be utterly and forever abolished in the United States, end quote. Notably, before the president, his cabinet, members of the Supreme Court, and numerous congressmen and senators, Douglas remarks in 1876 that forms of slavery still exist in the United States, and he enlists the spirit of the dead Lincoln to help him to continue his fight for racial equality. Douglas goes on to praise Lincoln for ending the slave trade in Washington, D.C., for allowing 200,000 African Americans to fight for their liberty, and for being the first American president to recognize the Black Republic of Haiti. It is only at the end of the speech, which throughout, I think, is implicitly informed by Douglas's interactions with Lincoln and informed by his sense that he had been an important influence on Lincoln, that Douglas lets the personal come to the fore. No man who knew Abraham Lincoln, says Douglas, the man who would regularly let the world know he knew Abraham Lincoln, could hate him. But because of his fidelity to union and liberty, he is doubly dear to us and will be precious forever, end quote. Douglas told many tales of Lincoln, offering conflicting views on his management of the Civil War and offering various but generally complimentary stories about their meetings. Here, Douglas offers judgment, and that judgment overall is good. In Douglas's writings about Lincoln, I see anger, conflict, and hope. And what I'm most struck by is Douglas's canny and often moving efforts to make use of his friendship or association with Lincoln to continue his fight for racial equality. Douglas was no manacled slave looking up to a beneficent Lincoln in gratitude for things he did and did not do. He was a rhetorically gifted political visionary who, as his 1876 speech shows, had a clear-eyed view of Lincoln and a clear-eyed sense of the rhetorical uses he could make of their association. Canny as Douglas was, I can't resist saying that I think he probably did come to love Lincoln, and that as he dealt with racist politicians like President Andrew Johnson, and then witnessed the failure of Reconstruction, he came to miss his presence and to appreciate him all the more. That might sound like the end of this of my talk, but I have one more paragraph. Some speakers conclude with a quote that sums up what they've been arguing. But I've decided to end with a quote from Douglas that someone else could use to give a very different talk about Douglas and Lincoln. In 1886, 11 years after he gave his speech on the Freedmen's Monument, Douglas contributed a short essay on Lincoln to a book titled Reminiscences of Abraham Lincoln by Distinguished Men of His Time. And this book was collected and edited by Alan Rice, editor of the North American Review. This is how Douglas concludes his essay. Quote, "I felt in his presence I was in the presence of a very great man, as great as the greatest. I felt as though I could go and put my hand on his if I wanted to put my hand on his shoulder. Of course, I did not do it, but I felt that I could. I felt that I was in the presence of a big brother and that there was safety in the atmosphere," end quote. I look forward to a talk or essay that takes the somewhat homoerotic quote about touching Big Brother Lincoln as its starting point. Whitman famously said about himself, "I contain multitudes." The same could be said for the Douglas-Lincoln relationship during the Civil War and beyond. Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Texas A&M University's Division of Research. To learn more about the Texas A&M Institute of Advanced Study or listen to additional podcasts in this series, please visit tias.tamu.edu.